Having looked at the stories of Irvine, Columbia and Woodlands, I'm now turning to evaluate how well they worked. And I examined them in terms of 40 different criteria related to the costs and benefits of sprawl. Issues of aesthetics, identity and a sense of place, social equity, social diversity and affordability, the efficiency and cost of the development, were they cost effective, environmental issues, both open space preservation, habitat protection and energy use, and then looking at whether they managed to maintain the benefits that urban sprawl can give, issues like choice and privacy. And I need to say that all are well liked by their residents. People who move there and don't move away have high life satisfaction. Opinion polls show a great liking for them as places. And as you can see, it's a complicated thing to evaluate such developments against so many criteria. But the overall picture is that they did pretty well. There are a number of aesthetic problems with suburban sprawl, from strip development to ugliness, and they've managed to create a sense of place and gotten rid of many of the features that people find unattractive. They have terrific pedestrian path systems, a lot of options for getting around, but they still have a great many people who drive to work alone. Somewhere around 80% of their populations do that, in spite of having a lot of jobs in the local area. In addition, while they have a significant affordable housing, it's much less than many of their proponents had hoped, and mostly through government intervention. They had hoped to be very efficient and cost-effective in creating their infrastructure, and while they certainly were efficient, they had to provide such high-quality infrastructure up front that it became quite expensive, so that they have terrific infrastructure that was probably cheaper than other terrific infrastructure but still costs a lot of money. They also have very interesting populations. They've maintained a high level of ethnic diversity. Irvine is only 57% non-Hispanic white, which shows quite a lot of diversity for Orange County. Columbia has maintained a substantial African-American population for its entire history and become more diverse as others have moved in. They have quite a significant amount of attached housing, particularly Irvine and Columbia. But they're fairly expensive developments, and people in these developments on average have high incomes. I wanted to compare them as well with some of the new urbanist developments that have been proposed and built in recent years. And this chart compares the three developments, Columbia, Irvine, and the Woodlands, with two exemplary new urbanist developments, Kentlands in Maryland and the Stapleton Airport reuse in Denver. The data for Kentlands is as it was constructed, and for Stapleton it was as is planned. I show three different kinds of densities: the citywide density, a typical village, and the densest village. In general, as a village density is always going to, which is a smaller area, is always going to be bigger than a city level density, because a city level density includes lots of non-residential uses. And I'm talking about housing units per acre. And what you can see is that Irvine is actually more dense than Kentlands, which is held up as a real pioneer of increasingly efficient, walkable communities. As a whole, they have fairly low city-wide densities, but still within the range for what we see of as smart growth. The Woodlands has the lowest overall densities, and that's because of its ecological values. It's actually privileging or prioritizing hydrological functioning, having a water system that is treated on-site and integrated with the overall development. That lowers its density. It makes it harder for it to be energy efficient, but it does mean that it has a sort of functioning natural system within the overall area. So overall, these three developments actually stack up very well against the most recent approaches to urban development in the United States in terms of their efficiency, their capacity to support public transit, and their capacity to protect open space. Just overall, all managed to do better than suburban sprawl. But they are also part of a new town tradition that was occurring not only in the United States, but overseas. And I'm going to talk a little bit about two other developments. One from that same period, Almere in the Netherlands outside Amsterdam, which is a development started in the 1970s and planned for about 400,000 people like Irvine. And then Hammarby-Hochstadt, a large redevelopment that was initially proposed as an Olympic site in Stockholm. That's a development from the 1990s, but shows a number of the European approaches to the same urban problems. And then I'll reflect a little bit on how the Chinese are starting to create a large new town program as well. You know, these planned communities that I've been talking about come from a long tradition of trying to build better suburbs starting in the 19th century with elite suburbs, colonial cities, and company towns. This was really crystallized in the late 19th and early 20th century in a movement called the Garden City Movement, started in Britain by a person called Ebenezer Howard, but spreading across the world very quickly to Europe, Asia, and Australasia. It was an idea of having self-contained planned communities that were satellites around a larger city that could meld the best of town and country. And they were proposed initially to be about 30,000 people. And then as the ideas developed over the years, they were lifted to 100,000 or 400,000 people. These post-war planned communities in the US I've been talking about are part of that movement. But there are also movements in Britain, the Netherlands, Sweden, and in Asia and the Middle East in the same period. So Almere comes out of this movement in Europe in the 70s and planned originally for around 250,000 people as a suburb of Amsterdam. It was planned by a government planning team on land reclaimed from the sea. It was very influenced by a number of British ideas that were also influencing the planned communities in the United States, particularly a worry about what would happen when automobiles became ubiquitous. Almere is very interesting in that it has a very high percentage of affordable housing, initially around over 40%. It's been declining lately, so it's more like 30% at the moment. But it's a very high percentage compared with United States examples. And it also has a high percentage of immigrants, around 30%, including 15% non-Western. And what's interesting about Almere is that it does this in a much more compact version than United States examples. And it does it in a way that's very transit-oriented. Its overall concept that you can see is of a rail sort of spine that is linked together with bus rapid transit loops. Bicycle paths feed it. Walking paths connect bicycle paths or parallel bicycle paths, and cars are kept on the outside. So there's a joke in Almere that it takes you 10 minutes to walk and an hour to drive because they make it so difficult to drive. It's a very impressive transportation system really aimed at getting people out of the car and into transit, and that's been very successful in that way. It's also a very aesthetically pleasing and diverse area, from small single-family homes to larger apartments. It has a Cornell connection in that Toon Coolhouse, the brother of Rem Coolhouse, who's designing Milstein Hall addition to the Architecture, Art, and Planning School, Toon Coolhouse was one of the initial designers. And Rem Coolhouse has led the planning for the new downtown in Almere. Hammarby Sjöstad in Stockholm is a smaller development, only planned for 20 to 25,000 residents on about 200 hectares, but it has extremely innovative environmental features. It was not initially planned as an ecological new town, it was, or an ecological redevelopment within an existing city, but it was greened in order to try and get the Olympic bid for Stockholm. When that failed, it kept its ecological plan. It's been designed like Almere by the city agencies, or the government agencies, in this case the city of Stockholm. And they have a very imaginative environmental program, thinking about soil pollution, energy, water and sewage. People cook with sewer gas. The sewer gas runs the buses. They have extensive noise protection. Everyone is meant to have a view of blue or green. They have incredible logistics to try and reduce the energy wastage of transportation of construction materials. It's a very, very integrated design. It's very high density, most people living in apartments, but it's high density and transit oriented with extensive open spaces. One of these images shows a green roof over a bicycle parking lot on top of the car parking lot. There are children's playgrounds that are natural. They have a vacuum system for recycling. You put your recycling in the recycling bin and the vacuum sucks it away. Just tremendous on-site water treatment. And they do this through very comprehensive planning, where every design has to fit into a model that's tested. It's very expensive, however, and so there, even though it's a government-developed new town, it's only available to people with some wealth. I compared the density of these two developments with Columbia Irvine and the Woodlands and with Kentlands. And what you can see is that Hammarby Sjöstad is far more intensively developed. And why this matters is it means that transit is much more supportable. It is very efficient in other forms of infrastructure that makes it cost effective, although being a brownfield site, the remediation was very expensive. But even Almere, built on fill in a very suburban location, has a much more intensively developed urban fabric. And that allows it to support transit, to provide more affordable housing, and to really have a large amount of connected open space on the edge of the development. So there are some ways in which these European examples are quite different and provide and show some models for what might be needed if the developments in the United States were to become really more transit-oriented and to provide more alternatives to the car. The current location for large-scale planned community development is really in Asia. Asia has long had a strong new town program, particularly in countries influenced by British planning, such as Japan or Singapore. But China's urbanization in the last decade or so has really led to a push to create large-scale planned communities in China, with many, many sort of thousands of new developments and some substantial number of very large new developments in the 100,000 or more range. Currently, it seems in China, every one of them is an eco-development. It's hard to know what is going to happen in China because it's so new, and these developments take decades to achieve. But this is really the place to watch in terms of large-scale planned communities in the world. So now you know quite a lot about the new community experiment, trying to provide alternatives to urban sprawl. through private sector innovation. You know a lot about three of them, Irvine, Columbia, and The Woodlands, and how well they worked, as well as some comparisons with European examples of similar scale and period, showing some many similarities but some significant differences. And as the world adds these billions of people over the next century, suburban development really will be an important place to be rethinking how cities and metropolitan areas are formed. And these planned communities can teach us a lot about what it is possible to do, and in the U.S., particularly what it is possible for the private sector alone to do, and where government might really have a role.